This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat, and I'm honored to be in dialogue today with my guest, Dr. Alexander Green. Dr. Green is a visiting associate professor and Buffalo Community Jewish educator at SUNY University at Buffalo in the Department of Jewish Thought. We are here today to discuss his new book, Power and Progress, Joseph Ibn Caspi and the Meaning of History, published in Albany by State University of New York Press, 2019. Alex, I'm absolutely grateful to be in dialogue with you today.
Thank you, Ari. It's my pleasure to be here.
To begin, please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up, and were there any formative events in your early life that stimulated the scholar you would later become?
Thank you. Well, I grew up in Toronto, really Thornhill, not too far from you. We're almost neighbors.
Yes, we live around the corner from each other.
Or at least where I grew up was not too far from you. And
yeah.
Went to Jewish day school, studied classical Jewish texts. And I would say when I got to university, I was originally going to go into computer science. I was more practical, but I was drawn in by the larger philosophical and ethical questions, both in Western philosophy and Jewish philosophy. And that drew me to Israel, where I did my MA in Jewish thought at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, which was really an incredible environment. And I was able to study with some of the top scholars in the field, in medieval Jewish philosophy, in Kabbalah, in modern Jewish thought. And I was very lucky too. That really stimulated my excitement to continue thinking about these big questions of ethics and philosophy and Judaism. And, it really created the environment that led me to where I am today.
What inspired you to write this book? What do you hope your readers will gain from it?
So let me perhaps talk a little bit about also, if it's okay, my first book as well, because there's a link between
absolutely,
the two.
Please.
I'll just mention my first book as well. So I really started, which was originally my dissertation, which became my first book, The Virtue Ethics of Levi Gersonides. I examined a Jewish philosopher and biblical commentator, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, the Ralbag, or Gersonides, who lived in Provence at the same time as Ibn Caspi. And I was really interested at the time how do Jewish philosophers after Maimonides think about ethics in the Middle Ages? How did they think about questions of happiness, of the active versus contemplative life, of the meaning of friendship, or what are the right virtues, moral virtues, intellectual virtues? And not that Maimonides was the only voice, because he really made it perhaps most famous in his work, such as the 8 chapters, the Shmoneh Prakim, and in the Hilchot Deot, the Mishnah Torah. But how did ethics continue after him? what how did he create a tradition of a Jewish Aristotelian tradition of ethical thinking that both continued and debated and disagreed with him? And this led me originally to Gersonides and then eventually to Ibn Kaspi. So my first book, I was thinking about what is virtue in Gersonides. And Gersonides had put a lot of emphasis on, not only on the moral virtues of courage and moderation and temperance and gentleness and all these important virtues that should be at the mean, but also the virtues of human survival, both the virtues of human survival of the body and also the virtues of altruism. And he dealt a lot with the issues of moral conflict, about how do human beings reconcile competing moral demands that are sometimes hard to reconcile. And I realized that Gersonides was writing in the 14th century, responding to two new works that were just translated to Hebrew, Averroes' commentary on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics and Averroes' commentary on Plato's Republic, both translated to Hebrew in the 1320s by Samuel ben Judah. Gersonides was reading these works, but also was Ibn Kaspi, both living in Provence in the 14th century, and both reading these works, but presenting their own interpretations. I would say one commonality between Gersonides and Ibn Kaspi is that both took the reality of bodily survival, the physical survival of the body, seriously as a human concern. I think you would say medieval Jewish philosophers are often attributed, or at least, I don't know, it's not false, but they're often presented as focusing purely on the intellect, that the highest goal of human life is the intellect and the knowledge of God and the highest knowledge of nature, and that everything else, ethics, is merely a means towards that highest goal. And I think one thing that both Gersonides and Ibn Kaspi were doing is that both thinkers and commentators were suggesting that the intellect is not enough. You have to also have ethics, and you have to take ethics seriously, and you have to focus on the body first. You can't have the intellect if you don't first have the body, and you don't first focus on the body. So there's, and it comes out differently in Gersonides and Ibn Kaspi, but that's one commonality between them. I think, I'll talk more about, you know, how that plays out in Ibn Kaspi as we, I think, proceed, but I would say, generally, one that sort of stimulated me to write this book is, and really write both these books, is that issue and that question. I think one thing I hope that people, readers of the book, will think about is how medieval Jewish philosophers were complex thinkers who took ethics seriously and reflected on the tough moral and political questions and conflicts that human beings face.
Can you share with us an outline of Joseph Ibn Kaspi's biography?
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about his biography, because he has an interesting biography that it's worth reflecting on for a second. So let me start with his gifts. Give me a second. I want to make sure I don't just make up my facts here. But so here's what I can say about his biography. He lived from 1280 to 1345. He was a philosopher. He was a biblical commentator. He was a grammarian. He wrote commentaries on Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed. He wrote commentaries on almost the entire Hebrew Bible. He wrote a dictionary of Hebrew roots. He wrote summaries of Aristotelian logic. He even wrote some of his own theological works. And he had a famous statement that I write reference in the book, that the Guide of the Perplexed is the most perfect work written after the Bible, that revealed and hints all the secrets of the Bible. So he's interested, really, he's a philosopher who's very interested both in Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed, but also in the Hebrew Bible. And that you can see that in the works that he wrote. But what about his personal life? That's important for me to talk about in terms of his biography. We know he was married. He had two sons and a daughter. We know that his oldest grandson converted to Christianity, and that may be a factor in his writings that we see is often very polemical with Christianity and Christians. He was someone with very strong opinions. He had no hesitation in being very open and critical of others in his writings. He describes the masses as horses and mules. He's often very critical of the appearance of local rabbis. He's critical of women. He's not often the most gentle of personalities, put it that way. And you can see that in his writings. We also know that he was a frequent traveler. He was seemingly never staying in a single place too long. He was traveling around the world in terms of where he wrote his different works. He was often in different locations. One of his most famous trips, and this is described in one of his writings, in one of his biblical commentaries, is he went down to Egypt to meet the great-grandson of Maimonides. And he wanted to, you know, he wanted to meet the descendants of the great Rambam. And he talks about how disappointed he was upon meeting the descendants of Maimonides. They weren't at the level philosophically that he hoped they would be. I think he's unique, and I don't know if there's anyone else medieval story of someone who sort of went down and said, like, I'm going on a fan trip to meet the Maimonides family, like going down, you know, to Cooperstown, like the Baseball Hall of Fame. And, you know, I want to meet the great descendants of Maimonides, and then talking about how, you know, he was disillusioned. Not that he was disillusioned with Maimonides, but he was disillusioned with his descendants. And, this trip down to Egypt was interesting. It's like we can talk about, which is that he felt that when he went to Egypt and he learned about Egypt, because he was in Provence, southern France, he learned certain facets, he felt, of Egyptian culture and society. And he usually used that on occasion to interpret the Bible, and felt that you could explain different elements of the Bible's story by saying, well, that's the way it's done in Egypt, because he said, I witnessed it myself. Now, there are some problems with this, which we could get into, but just telling you about this from his the biographical side here. We don't really know why he moved around so much. I mean, there's different scholarly theses, hypotheses, what it might be. People think maybe he had marriage troubles, or he was escaping Christian persecution. Maybe he was just visiting his children, or maybe he had disputes with other Jewish scholars. Could be that he was meeting other philosophical colleagues. I mean, these are all possibilities that seem plausible based on certain things we know about him, but we don't have absolute certainty from his writings what the reason for his travels are. So that's a short biography, a little some information about his bio. And he has a bit of a colorful bio. I mean, I would say that not every character, medieval Jewish philosopher, we know about their biography. I would say, you know, Maimonides, we have a lot of information about his biography because we have the Cairo Geniza, and we can see all these letters that he wrote, and people maintained his writings, different letters he wrote, and we have the Cairo Geniza. We can find all kinds of things about his life and letters he wrote. You know, someone like Gersonides, who I mentioned, who I wrote my first book on, we don't have a lot about his bio. I mean, some scholars went into the archives and found some small details here and there, but we know he, you know, someone like Gersonides, we know he did some work for the Pope on astronomical research, but it's not like we have a large bio. So it's in some medieval figures we have, you know, a lot about them biographically, and others we know very little.
What are the most important moral teachings of Joseph Ibn Kaspi?
So I'd put it as such. I would say that for Ibn Kaspi, history is contingent and open. That there's no set goal to history, unlike perhaps modern philosophers like Hegel, who would say we're moving towards a certain goal in history. I would say for Ibn Kaspi, history is free, it's open. We're free to choose good or bad. The future is up to us. And that has its advantages and disadvantages, because he would say the chaos of so many historical events that nations rise and fall is because people are free and they make good decisions and they make bad decisions. On the other hand, he also suggests that the Torah, there's a sort of intellectual progress in the Torah, that knowledge has accumulated over time, that people know more about nature, there's a certain greater progress of enlightenment. So he thinks that there's both enlightenment and there's certain progress to enlightenment, but there's also a certain uncertainty and openness or contingency to history. And these both play out at the same time for him.
What contribution might Ibn Kaspi make in regard to contemporary and current debates regarding Zionism and Israeli history?
So that's an interesting question. It's an interesting question because I wouldn't be the first to answer that. Actually, there's sort of a larger historical precedent here, because in the 19th century, there were a bunch of scholars who read Ibn Kaspi as a sort of proto-Zionist. That's probably too strong a term. Because he's not necessarily suggesting anything like that, but he is arguing, and it's in his work called Tam HaKesef, and it's in a famous chapter where he argues, and this follows from what I think said previously, there's a link here, that Jews have been exiled from their land, they've lost sovereignty, but history is contingent, and history is open, and anything is possible. And therefore, he said, if you give it enough time, the chances are, one day, Jews are going to go back, and they're going to sort of rebuild their ancient sovereign kingdom that they once had. So he was saying, if anything is possible, that's likely possible enough too. And if you wait long enough, you'll see that happen too. So he's not going and sort of predicting that in a certain era there's going to be this sort of historical movement that's going to come around. But he's also, like, I guess you could say someone like Max Nordau, he's saying Jews don't have to wait for the Messiah. They don't have to sit around patiently waiting on divine action. It's based on human action. History is open. History leaves open the possibility of human beings taking action in their own hands. So this is a debate about how, so in that sense, even Kaspi could see someone who saw human history as a more secular process, as something that God's not sort of pulling the strings, God's not controlling everything. And there is a certain parallel between those and some of the arguments that later arose in modern Jewish history. And Ibn Kaspi is often looked to as a precedent for that. There's a famous article that discusses that by Shlomo Pines, the great translator of Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed. He has an article where he connects Ibn Kaspi and Spinoza and asks whether Ibn Kaspi is a precedent for Spinoza on the question of, Jewish sovereignty in Israel. And this goes back to, when it comes to Spinoza, a famous line at the end of the third chapter of the Theological Political Treatise. But that's a whole other conversation to try to figure out what that line means in Spinoza. But I'll just make that reference for those who want to look further.
What aspects of Joseph Ibn Kaspi's theology and philosophy are unique vis-a-vis other Jewish Aristotelians of his period? In what ways does Ibn Kaspi differ from Ralbag Gersonides, Ibn Falakera, Al-Balagh, Pulkar, and others in his period who also were influenced by Maimonides, also engaged very seriously with Aristotle's philosophy? In what ways is he similar to them? In what ways is he unique?
Yeah, that's a great question. So thank you. I would say that one facet that makes the Jewish Aristotelians similar is that they all hold contemplation as the ideal. They all hold that knowledge of God and knowledge of nature is sort of the highest human pursuit. In that sense, you could say they're Aristotelians, because that you see that image at the end of book 10 of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, where he presents that image of the highest life is contemplation. And I would say that the Jewish interpreters who wanted to reconcile Aristotle and the Torah had to read the Torah in such a way that the purpose of the Torah is to acquire that knowledge, is to have the knowledge of nature. That actually, that's what the Torah is trying to do, is to teach you how to understand nature as a whole. And many said that really the Torah is the best vehicle for the understanding of nature. And sometimes in polemics with Christianity, they would say, well, the Torah is actually a better version of vehicle to understand nature than other religions. And that was sort of a polemic that was going on, and we see that in Ibn Kaspi. So that's something that makes, I would say, a lot of this tradition unique, like that's a common thread. But there's also subtle differences, and I don't want to suggest that medieval Jewish Aristotelians were all the same. I think one of the aspects that makes Ibn Kaspi different, and maybe that makes both Gersonides and Ibn Kaspi different, and why I've written on both of them, at least at this point in my career, is that and this is one thing, there's a famous article from Falakera that makes this point, that many of the post-Maimonidean Jewish philosophers felt that if the perfection of the intellect is really what life is all about, the Torah is all about, then ethics is just sort of, something you need to do. It's just sort of like a bunch of rules to keep you focused in your life, but it's not really the most important thing. It's just a means towards intellectual perfection. And it's ethics, and some even go far as ritual law, are not really the most important thing. If you want to come back to that, and even Kaspi, all, we can raise that point later as well, because there's something to say there also. But I think what makes Gersonides and Ibn Kaspi different is that as much as they hold that intellectualist ideal, they also say that one has to take the needs of the body seriously. One can't focus just on the intellect. One has to look at the realities of the world, ethical, historical, political, and take them seriously, because the intellect can't exist without the body. We are embodied creatures, and we need to focus also on the way the world works in a physical sense. And I think that's one aspect that we see of these philosophers, the 14th century. You might say they're not ascetic, or they don't think human beings can just be ascetic creatures focusing on the contemplation of the heavenly bodies alone. There has to be a component of either worldly awareness or worldly involvement in some sense. And that doesn't mean that he thinks that Jewish thinkers have to be philosopher kings and, you know, taking political power in that sense, but they have to be aware of the obligations of what it means to live in this life. For Gersonides, that means you have to perfect certain physical virtues, which I would organize as ones called hishtalut, endeavor, and charitzut, diligence, and hitrachmut as well, cunning, strategies. And these are virtues that deal with how to just survive in the world. There's a whole set of character traits that deal with that. I think for Ibn Kaspi, who's perhaps similar in some regards, but also a little bit different, he would say we have to be aware of the rise and fall of kingdoms. We have to be aware of the contingent elements of history. We can't ignore history. We can't ignore that there's historical empires who are vying for power, and sometimes an empire is going to rise, sometimes it's going to fall. And that's an important part of the world that we have to be aware of, and that we're living in societies that require sometimes our guidance, maybe not direct involvement, but we have to at least be aware of that power dynamics that's at play in the world around us. I think in earlier Maimonideans, I would say from the 13th century, they often at least said that wasn't as an important role for a Jewish philosopher to think about. Jewish philosophers should focus on the contemplation of the cosmos. You know, you got to be a little bit ethical, but that's not really the focus of human life.
What unique contribution does your book make to the study of Ibn Kaspi's thought and writing? How does your book advance contemporary scholarship on Ibn Kaspi? Where do you situate your book amid contemporary scholarship in the field of medieval Jewish philosophy?
Good question. Something I have to, I want to answer seriously, because it's an important question. So I think I'm bringing out in my book the aspects of Ibn Kaspi that is aware of the historical, that's aware of these historical trends, and that history is can be looked at as some kind of pattern, and that there's certain rules that govern history. I don't want to say I'm completely innovative in this field, because I would say that I will be thankful to two different articles I mentioned in the introduction that laid the groundwork for these. And these were an article by Shlomo Pines and an article by Isidore Twersky, both notable scholars of medieval Jewish philosophy, one at Hebrew University of Jerusalem and one at Harvard. And both wrote important articles where they brought out that Ibn Kaspi's awareness of history as some kind of pattern of events over time. And I tried to bring that out in a more serious way in my book, and try to look at all of Ibn Kaspi's writings and draw that out as to suggest that he has different models of history that are operating simultaneously. And that's really what comes down to the title of the book, we call it Power and Progress. These are two different models for how history operates for Ibn Kaspi. One that is the contingent history of kingdoms rising and falling, that's often based on power. And the other is that history operates as a progressive enlightenment over time. He felt that the knowledge of nature, which is exemplified in this image of the divine chariot in the Hebrew Bible, is something which has actually been revealed more over time. He actually thinks the Bible is a tool to progressively reveal that element, that truth about nature. And it's not necessarily just a Jewish truth. It's, you know, it's nature. Nature is exists as a whole. But you know, how he'd respond to Christians who would say is also a related question we could talk about. So my book is trying to bring out how that operates seriously for Ibn Kaspi. And also there's an element of, you might say, historicism, which is another way of which is to say that to understand the Bible in its historical context. I'm not suggesting that Ibn Kaspi was a modern biblical critic in that regard, that he would reduce the Bible to history, because he did see the Bible as philosophy. But he also suggested there were certain parts of the Bible that could be looked at historically. This goes back to what I mentioned about his trip to Egypt, where he felt that when he went to Egypt, he saw different facets of Egyptian culture, and that those facets could be used as a way of interpreting certain mysterious elements of the Bible that we weren't aware of. Now, I don't want to suggest he's just historicizing the Bible, but there are certain times he does employ that as well. And that's one thing Isidore Twersky brings out in his article at Ibn Kaspi, which is a very interesting article for those. I definitely recommend it for those who haven't read it, one of his classic articles. And there he brings out the historicist, might say that Ibn Kaspi, he brings how much Ibn Kaspi is a historicist, how much he relies on societal and cultural factors in trying to understand certain parts of the Bible.
Speaking of the divine chariots, can you elaborate on his interpretation of the meaning of the divine chariots? How does his interpretation of the divine chariot underpin the ideas that are central to his worldview?
Yeah, it's important to understand that. And I mean, Ibn Kaspi is not unique here. I think I want to bring that out. I'm not suggesting he is the first in any way to do this. There's a long tradition going back to the rabbis about this image of God, or this, let's say, just an image of someone riding on a chariot in the Bible, and this being considered by the rabbis one of the great secrets of the Torah, described in the Mishnah and Chagiga, the Maaseh Merkava. And this was Maimonides, who Ibn Kaspi looks to as who is sort of his guide, brings this out and suggests that part of what he's doing, and Maimonides is doing in the Guide of the Perplexed, is to revealing the tradition of the divine chariot, or I guess revealing and concealing elements of the divine chariot that were lost. He is sort of that the secrets of a divine chariot were lost over time, and that Maimonides, in writing his work, is trying to introduce people to it, but not introduce them too much. And what is this image? I should say, I don't want to assume that the listeners know. If you look at sixth chapter of Isaiah, first chapter of Ezekiel, 10th chapter of Ezekiel especially, these are chapters in the Bible where you have this image of someone riding. Well, the images are different. You have a very terse description, I'm just saying, chapter 6 of Isaiah, and a very detailed description, especially in the first chapter of Ezekiel, where you have this image of someone riding on a chariot, and it's a chariot in the heavens, and that chariot has pulled by different creatures, and part of, at least in Ezekiel version, that those creatures have different faces of different animals, and there's wheels, and the wheels are turning, and the wheels have eyes in them. Now, this, to understand what this means, it's at least interpreted to be very allegorical by later interpreters. And I think the way Ibn Kaspi reads this, it's important to know, is this image is a allegory for nature. It's an allegory for the natural world, where the rider, the horses, and the wheels each represent different parts of the tripartite level of hierarchy of nature, according to the Aristotelian sciences, where the riders of the chariot represent the separate intellects, the horses represent the celestial spheres, which the planets are on, and the wheels represent the world of matter, the world of four elements. So he felt that by understanding the chariot, this image, it's all about nature. Now, that's really what's underneath the Torah as a whole in Ibn Kaspi's version. Now, he makes a point, I don't know if that when the temple was destroyed, these other nations took the secrets of divine chariot from the Jews, and they took them and they brought them into their own traditions. So he argues that, and he's not the only one who makes this, it's an argument that's prevalent throughout medieval Jewish thought, that actually the secrets of nature and philosophy are really Jewish ideas that were taken by the Greeks and the Romans and appropriated as their own and made. But really, it's the job of the of us writing to his Jewish compatriots to reclaim our lost tradition. And that when they conquered us, they took our philosophical secrets and ran away with it and made it their own. So really, Aristotle is really articulating the truths of the Bible. He's articulating these secret truths that are embedded in the Bible, but making them public and developing them. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should necessarily see this as historical truth, but it is part of the narrative that Ibn Caspian and other medieval thinkers have written about. There's a book actually that's written on this theme, not written by me, by someone else, that actually that goes through the entire history of this image or myth of the secrets of philosophy really being Jewish.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You alluded to this briefly earlier, but I'd be curious to ask you, what were Ibn Caspi's views on Christianity? Can you comment in more detail about what his perspective was on the Christian religion in relation to the Jewish religion?
Yeah, this is an important point that it's important to discuss when looking at Ibn Caspi. And one should note that medieval Jewish philosophers, especially living in the Christian world, were in polemical dialogue or polemics with Christianity. And Ibn Caspi is not unique here. Many medieval Jewish philosophers living in the Christian world were arguing over whether philosophy is closer to Judaism or Christianity and trying to use the tools of philosophy to defend their own religion. And Ibn Caspi does so here. Whether it's for personal reasons or because of he's having debates for communal reasons, here's what he says about how Judaism and Christianity relate. I'll try to articulate, I think, in about 3 points that we should lay out. So he thinks that both Judaism and Christianity are religions founded by philosophers. He thinks that both religions, to a certain extent, have the same philosophic truth contained within it. So he's not bothered by seeing the Trinity by saying, well, Judaism has an idea of Trinity too. But what he thinks differentiates Judaism and Christianity is to say that in his polemical argument, Christianity reserves the truth for an elite. So it keeps the truth as sort of hidden within the text as opposed to within the holy text. So Christianity doesn't try to bring its adherents, he argues, into philosophical truth. While Judaism, he thinks its holy texts, tries to use the tools of the holy text to bring people towards greater enlightenment. So it's constructed pedagogically to try to enlighten its adherents. And he thinks that's the difference between Judaism and Christianity on a sort of textual level. It's not that one is philosophical, one's not into philosophy. He thinks both are philosophical, but Christianity doesn't give it, the philosophy's hidden. You don't know how to get to it. Judaism, the whole structure of the Hebrew, of the text in Hebrew, are there to get you to be a more educated, enlightened person, to understand the secrets and truths of philosophy that are of that, what he would say in him, his image of the divine chariot that are embedded within the text. So it plays out in three ways. So I'm going to bat, I said three. I'm not, nothing to do with Trinity here, but three just because that's the way it plays out, which is number one, Hebrew language. He has a very interesting philosophy of Hebrew language, which is that the Hebrew language, the way it's structured, is actually a mirror of the natural world. That Hebrew language has nature and the structure, the meaning of the principles of nature built into the structure of the roots of the Hebrew language. And that to understand the Torah as a vehicle to understand nature, then you have to look at it in its origin. Because he thinks, and this seems that every Hebrew root, every shoresh, has a certain principle, an idea embedded within that shoresh. And this is why he actually wrote a Hebrew dictionary called Sharshot Kesef, where he, in that dictionary, he tries to say, well, every usage of the same three-letter root throughout the Bible actually is connected in some kind of common theme. And he tries to prove that. So he argues that when Christians read the Bible in translation, and here he often polemicizes against the translation of the Bible into Latin. He does this often in his work called Shulchan Kesef, but I think it's in other places too, where he argues that the translation of the Bible into Latin misses its original meaning because it doesn't reveal the depths of the Hebrew, which is built into the roots of the Hebrew letters of the Shoresh itself. So that's one critique of Christianity that he makes, and he starts different. Another thing he argues is that the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, hermeneutically is constructed to guide people towards truth. So he has all these hermeneutical tools that he argues are in the Bible, like things like the Bible repeats words, and it has empty spaces, and it has all these different tools. It often contradicts itself. He says that's one thing about the Jewish Bible, the Torah, that is there to guide its readers towards this truth in a way that he thinks that other holy scriptures don't do. And the third point, which is something that came out of our discussions, but I didn't draw out the implications for his polemic with Christianity, he said he thinks that Christians, interpreters of the Hebrew Bible, misunderstand its prophetic teachings. He says they read an eschatological reading into many of the prophetic books. They read a teaching that talks about the end of history or of some kind of transcendent history. And he argues that the biblical prophets were talking about prophetic, were prophesizing things that are going to happen in the immediate future, not in a distant future. The Bible, he says, the biblical prophets can't predict what's going to happen at the end of days. They don't know what's going to happen 500 years down the road. He actually says it's bad when Jewish readers do that. Jewish interpreters shouldn't do that either. He says, if you do that, Jewish interpreters who do that, they're actually supporting the Christian argument. He says, all that the biblical prophets are doing is predicting an immediate political future for the Israelite or Judean kingdoms in relation to their neighbors. They're not talking about a history that's going to happen in some kind of distant future. And therefore, he thinks that when Christian interpreters or even Jewish interpreters, we criticize this too, try to read in some kind of eschatological or long apocalyptic future in some kind of distant end of time or even just a distant far off time period, that's not the way prophecy works. And that connects to his idea that history is open and contingent, that there's no necessary direction to where history is going to go. It can go in multiple directions. And often the biblical prophets were saying, well, this is what's likely going to happen in the future. But even there, there's some openness. They thought that's what's going to happen, but they don't know for sure. And that if they can't know for sure what's going to happen in the immediate future, they're definitely not going to say they definitely don't know for sure what's going to happen 200, 500 years or whatever, like a long time away down the road. So I would say these are the three points that I would say Ibn Kasbi makes in his polemic with Christianity. Number one, language, Hebrew over Latin. Number two, hermeneutics, so how the text is structured as a holy text to guide its reader towards this philosophic truth. And number three, history being contingent and not eschatological. It's being open, or say contingent and immediate and not eschatological and long-term. He didn't write one work talking about this. I've pieced this together throughout studying all of his writing. So you're not going to open Ibn Kasbi and find a work where he says, this is my polemical argument against Christianity. These are just pieces that he gives you throughout all of his writings. And you have to go through them as a whole and try to put them together. But I do talk about them in my book.
In your perspective, what, if anything, can be done to make Ibn Kasbi's ideas more accessible to ordinary Jewish religious readers outside of academic Jewish studies?
So that's a challenge. I admit that's a challenge. I'll tell you why it's a challenge, but I don't think it's a challenge that should be given up. And it's a good one to try to accomplish, but it's not an easy one. And here are the obstacles I would lay out. First, I would say that few of his writings are in English. Few are in critical editions. That's one thing. But even the ones that there are critical editions, very few are in English. So we don't, you know, for the reader who doesn't know Hebrew, you're not going to find a lot of writing. What we do have in English is we have The Ethical Will that he wrote. And it's in a volume on Jewish ethical wills. There's Barry Mensch translated a work called Kfutzat Kesef, and Basil Herring translated one of his works called Gviat Kesef, Goblet of Silver. So there's a couple of his works, but he wrote about, I don't have the full number in front of me, but he wrote a lot more than this. And those are not his, like main biblical commentary. So for the Hebrew reader can access that, but for the English speaking reader will have trouble finding most of his writings. I would say a second point is that he didn't make it into the Mikro Gdolot. He never had a, Gersonides, who not all of his works are in the Mikro Gdolot. Mikro Gdolot is the rabbinic Bible compilation, the compilation of commentaries that was put together, you know, in the early modern period to try to assemble different commentaries and put them on the side of the text beside the Hebrew biblical text. Now, there's not one version of the Mikro Gdolot. There's a lot of different versions. You can look at the scholarship Barry Levy, who talks about this, about the different evolving Mikro Gdolot throughout time. But Ibn Kasbi never wasn't someone who made it even to any of the Mikro Gdolot. And he never really had consistent following historically. You see him critiqued in later sort of medieval commentary, like Abarbanel will critique him. I think maybe Arama too. But it wasn't like he had a consistent following. And that's one thing that makes his works different than Gersonides. Gersonides always had a following of readers. People republished his Toalot. Some of his biblical commentaries were some of the first printed Hebrew books. Ibn Kasbi never really had that. And I think only in the 19th century, his writings were recovered and reprinted by scholars. A third challenge, you might say, is that he's very philosophical and his writings are embedded in philosophical language and they're elusive and he doesn't always say what he's thinking. And it's often, if you're not an expert in Aristotelian philosophy, you might find some of the language off-putting. Another reason you might say that Gersonides and even that was more had more of a following is he wrote an independent theological work called Wars of the Lord. And he also wrote biblical commentaries. Well, Ibn Kasbi didn't write like a book that made it as sort of like its own independent treatise. He was often known as most of his work worked philosophy into his biblical interpretation. And I should say he also wasn't someone who wrote on Jewish law. He didn't deal with the commandments. There's an idea that often Maimonides was preserved. Maimonides was famous because the Gemara put it this way. The Guide of the Perplexed was preserved because he was also the author of the Mishnah Torah. That people preserved Maimonides' more radical philosophic views because he also was the more conservative halachist at the same time. And Ibn Kasbi wasn't as interested in Jewish law. In fact, you find places where he's very critical of himself and saying, I don't know much Jewish law. And there's a whole famous story about that, which we can go into as well, about his admitting his lack of knowledge of Jewish law. So there are certain obstacles one has towards reading Ibn Kasbi. But I do think his work is very interesting. And I do hope that perhaps when more is translated to English, and today it's been republished, new critical editions, I would say more people are interested in Ibn Kasbi today. And I would say people are interested in a wide variety of biblical commentaries today. There's an interest in not just following the more traditional biblical commentaries, the Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Nachmanides, but also looking at the variety of commentaries that didn't make it, that are not sort of the traditional canon. You might say also for those who are interested in science and religion and the question of if you think of medieval Jewish philosophy as in some ways all about the question of science and religion, even though their idea of science is different than ours, these commentaries like Ibn Kaspi are engaged with that. And I don't mean just Ibn Kaspi, but he's one of those post-Maimonidean Jewish biblical commentaries that commentators and within his commentaries that are thinking about how the world of science and the world of religion could come together. And that's not unique to him, but he's definitely fits within that trend of what medieval Jewish philosophers were thinking about and debating.
How did Ibn Kaspi understand the four beasts as depicted in the book of Daniel? How does this interpretation underpin his understanding of politics?
So yeah, that's a great image that he has in that book that Daniel has in the biblical book of Daniel. And it's in the seventh chapter of the book of Daniel. And for Ibn Kaspi, that's he places important on how to read that seventh chapter of the book of Daniel. You might say that that seventh chapter of the book of Daniel becomes a paradigm for how to look at Jewish history according to many medieval Jewish commentaries, because it presents this image of four animals that, at least as interpreted by Jewish tradition in the Midrash, as four kingdoms that oppress the Jews. So there's one animal. The first animal is an animal like a lion with eagle's wings. A second is an animal like a bear with three ribs between its teeth. The third is an animal like a leopard with four wings and four heads. And the fourth is an animal with large iron teeth and 10 horns. Now, if you interpret these allegorically, as Jewish interpreters have done, they're saying that these aren't just four animals. They're actually representing four kingdoms that are going to oppress the Jews throughout history. And the question is, who do you identify these four with? So I think traditionally, the first three are identified, at least in some form, with Babylonia, with Persia, and with Greece. But the question is, who is the fourth kingdom? And where do you fit Christianity and Islam into this portrait? Or is the fourth kingdom Christianity and Islam? Is the fourth animal? Or is the Christianity the third, and fourth is Islam? And so what even there's a lot of different interpretations of this, but I'll just focus on Ibn Kaspi's, which is that he doesn't see these as sort of like a linear process where once the third is done, then the fourth begins. He sees the third and fourth as actually both active at the same time. He says the third is Christianity, even though he sort of connects Greece, Rome, Christianity together. And so he would group those together as the third animal. And the fourth animal he would say is Islam. And he would say that Jews living in his own time period are living between the third and the fourth animal. And we don't know which one is going to win, which one's going to be victorious. And he thinks that these are not the only ones. So he doesn't see this as sort of like a set group, like once these are all done, then Jews are free and there won't be many more oppressors in history. He argues that these are four examples of oppressors that Jews will have throughout history, but it's not restricted to these four. And he thinks that, as I said, three is Christianity, four is Islam, and we're living between three and four, and we don't know which is going to win, because as I suggested earlier, history is contingent. History is open. There's no set goal for which it's moving towards. So who knows what's going to happen? Maybe you'll have a big Christian empire. Maybe you'll have a Muslim empire. Maybe you'll go back and forth. In his mind, he's open to whatever the future may hold. And he thinks that's really what's underlying this. And he actually describes this as a great, if I'm correct, I don't want to misquote this here, but I think he says the great secret of the Torah. Make sure I didn't lose you there for a second.
Mm-hmm.
You're here? Okay, good. And he says, quote, it's in Tama Kesef, where he says, who does not know, who does not see constantly the revivals and collapses of constantly alternating nations? Things go up and down. And this is one of the secrets of the Torah, that we don't know what direction history is going to be. We don't know who's going to be victorious down the road. And he thinks this is actually one of the ways of interpreting the Torah, is to understand this chapter of Daniel, chapter 7, at least understand the way history operates or may operate in the future, according to the Torah. So it's an important allegory that plays a central role in the way he understands Jewish history, but really history in general.
In what ways did Ibn Kaspi critique Maimonides' philosophical worldview, and on what grounds? Where did Ibn Kaspi agree with Maimonides, and where did he disagree?
So this is a tough one in some ways. I'll say why it's a tough one, because he considered himself a follower of Maimonides. He wrote two commentaries on Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed. He wrote a work called Amudei Kesef, Masks of Silver, and Maskiot Kesef, Settings of Silver. And these are, one is an exoteric, another is an esoteric commentary on the Guide. So not only did he write one commentary, he wrote two different commentaries on the Guide. And he wrote very clearly in one of his writings, the Guide is the most perfect work written after the Bible. So he's happy to jump right from the Bible to Maimonides in his framework. So he was in many ways a follower of Maimonides, but he would also, I think, say that he felt he was extolling Maimonides' true beliefs. So there's a lot of debates over what the Rambam taught, what Maimonides was teaching. It's not an easy one to figure out today. Scholars are still debating this question, and we're still not clear what the answer is. That's perhaps why it's interesting. But Ibn Kaspi felt that he was extolling, he was making known Maimonides' true beliefs. So, for example, he was pretty clear. He felt Maimonides' true belief was that the world is eternal, and that in the big question of the origin of the world, it wasn't the view of creation from nothing, or the view of the Platonic view of creation from pre-existent matter, but it was Aristotle's view of the eternity of the world. He felt that was Maimonides' true view, and if you read it carefully, you'd come to that conclusion. So he felt he was making that case. I would say in other areas, he was drawing out Maimonides' teaching, he felt he was bringing it out to the open, what Maimonides may have hinted to or implied. I mean, you could see certain areas where there seems to be some significant difference, and I bring this out in the book. Maimonides quotes Aristotle that human beings are political by nature, famously discusses that in Guide 240 of the Guide of the Perplexed. And we're naturally organized to want to live in communities we can't live as isolated individuals. This is indirectly a reference to Aristotle's Politics at the beginning. Not that Maimonides had it to read it directly from that source, but read it through Al-Farabi. And Ibn Kaspi, in some ways, doesn't take exactly that view. In fact, he says, and this is, I think it's in his commentary on Proverbs where I'm citing this here, where he says, man is political by necessity. And he emphasizes that human beings don't really, it's better not to be, and it's better to, not get too involved in your community. Maimonides might say, well, no, the greatest prophet was a lawgiver, was people who tried to perfect their society, make it better, make it more just. Well, Ibn Kaspi saying, stay away from being involved too much. It's very hard to perfect your society. Society has much corruption. It's often unjust. The rulers are often making decisions based on their whims. And history isn't really about justice. It's often driven by accident, by rhyme, reason. So as opposed to saying man is political by nature, he emphasized political by necessity. And I think that slight change is more than just an element of wording. It represents a big difference. Now, even though Ibn Kaspi says he's a follower of Maimonides, I think in certain areas, he takes him in a slightly different direction. And here you might say he's a little bit closer, at least Ibn Kaspi, to the Islamic philosopher Ibn Bajjah, who we were talking about, who emphasizes not wanting better to be in solitude, not wanting to get too involved in your surrounding community, and the danger of getting too involved. And Ibn Bajjah famously has a whole work where he discusses this explicitly. And Ibn Kaspi doesn't cite Ibn Bajjah directly here, but I think his perspective seems to be closer to that when it comes to how involved you should be in the surrounding society.
How might Ibn Kaspi, as a Jewish Aristotelian, respond to the contemporary claims of biblical criticism?
So how would Ibn Kaspi respond to biblical criticism? Now, of course, it's important to note that Ibn Kaspi, I've never heard of biblical criticism, because it's a movement that, a way of interpreting biblical texts that takes place after he lived in the modern era, and Ibn Kaspi writing in the medieval era. So of course he would not know of biblical criticism, but it is interesting to think about, are there certain parallels, and where, if you had to compare an Ibn Kaspian approach to the Bible to a modern biblical critical approach to the Bible, how would he differ? Where would he be similar? So I would say one area where there's a similarity is that he is open and, at times to the possibility of multiple authorship. And he notes that in, you know, he has an area, he has in his commentaries, he follows Maimonides' different lists of contradictions, that there's different contradictions in the texts. And he when he's talking about the first model of contradiction, this is a list that takes place in the beginning of the Guide of the Perplexed, for those who, you know, those readers, listeners who are not aware of what I'm referring to. And the first in that list of seven contradictions is a contradiction because it is a compilation of different authors and perspectives that were edited and placed beside each other in the same book. So he's not, he believes you can extend that to the Bible. He's open to saying the Bible has different authors and it was not all written by the same authorship, and you can find different authors within it. But he wouldn't go all the way to reducing the Bible to the purely the imaginative constructions of its authors. And here's where Ibn Kaspi differs. Here's, you know, you might say Spinoza, who was one of the founders of that of the modern biblical critical approach, famously said that the biblical authors have vivid imaginations. In other words, they're writing the text was based on their imagination. They were not scientifically educated. You don't go to the Bible for Spinoza for scientific truth. Go to your local scientist, go to your local philosopher. Don't go to the Bible. Spinoza was trying to wean people off trying to read the Bible scientifically or philosophically. So I think Ibn Kaspi would not go that far, because Ibn Kaspi still held that the Bible was a work at the level of philosophy. It was a work that he felt contained deep truths within the text, and was there to guide people to these truths. So in some ways, you see a little bit of both, perhaps. Ibn Kaspi is someone who, like the modern biblical approach, would say there are sometimes written by multiple authors, and there's an element of historicism. Sometimes you can understand the Bible in light of its historical approach, in light of its historical society. But he was also someone who said, like the more medieval approach, that the Bible is a work of truth. It's a work that's guiding you to these highest truths. It's not there just as a historical document that can be read in light of its surrounding culture and times. And how he would, you know, how he would get in a debate with, it would be interesting to see the debate if you could bring Ibn Kaspi back to life and bring a modern biblical critic beside him and then have that debate. It would be interesting to see how they would hash it out.
I'd be curious to ask you about a certain quote in your book on page 87, where you write the following: Ibn Kaspi defends the philosophers against the accusation that they do not pray to God, by arguing that even for philosophers, the order of prayer has a purpose. It teaches that God is the first cause and that God is one. Can you elaborate on that idea?
Let me look at it within a sort of larger trope of medieval Jewish thought, which is there was an accusation that philosophers did not take Jewish ritual seriously. I think that comes out of prayer, but it's in general an accusation that philosophers didn't pray, they didn't take Jewish ritual seriously because they were concerned with knowledge of God. They weren't concerned with all the rules. They were concerned with the highest goal, which is the highest knowledge of God. And they might say, well, if my focus is on the highest knowledge of God, why do I need prayer? Why do I need to focus on these rituals like prayer? So here he seems to be, in some ways, giving a justification for certain rituals, saying that even the philosophers who may be focused on knowledge can find value in ritual activities like prayer. It's not just for the rest of society. Even the elite can find it. But it is, I think this is a good place to insert and mention one of the famous stories about Ibn Kaspi that he's well known for, and this is mentioned in his Ethical Will, which is, he quotes in his Ethical Will, or he references a story he told about himself for a time when he was having a dinner party, and he was getting, people were there, And he was getting all the food ready. And he says, I can quote here, "I invited my friends to eat and drink with me, for it was a family party, and the luckless handmaid put a milk spoon into the meat pot. I did not know the ritual law, how one ought to estimate the lawfully permittable portion of intermixture." In other words, who am I? I'm interested in these, you know, knowledge of God. I don't know about, you know, the laws of kosher. You know, maybe I studied it when I was a kid. So I'll quote again. He says, "Perturbed in mind, as well as famished in body, I went to one of the rabbis, held high in popular repute. He was, for my sins, at table with his wife and family, eating drink and drinking wine. I waited at his door until the shades of evening fell, and my soul was near to leave me. He was then told me the law, and I returned home when my guests and poor were awaiting me. I related all that had happened, for I was not ashamed to admit myself unskilled in the particular craft. In this I lack skill, but I have skill in another craft. Is not the faculty of expounding the existence and unity of God as important as familiarity with the rule concerning a small milk spoon?" So to summarize, he had a party. He had some people over. Someone mixed milk and meat when he was cooking. He went to the local rabbi. The local rabbi was at his own, was having his own get together, too busy to talk to him to answer his halachic shaila about what to do with the spoon. So he ended up sitting outside. I guess he missed his party. I don't know. The guests were waiting there for hours, thinking, where did my host go for all this time? But they were just good hosts. They waited for him, which is nice. Maybe I would have left if my host just disappeared on me for a number of hours in the middle of the party. But he self-deprecatingly, and not only, I mean, in a positive way about himself, he says, "I'm not ashamed. You know, okay, I'm not an expert in kashrut. I didn't go and study that in yeshiva for so long, but I know something even greater," he says. "I know I can prove the existence of unity of God. Why do I care about the small milk spoon? Why is that as important to me?" And this story was often used to disparage the Jewish philosophers like Ibn Kaspi, who were saying, look at these, they don't know any halacha. You know, they're halachically ignorant. They don't know Jewish law. They're so concerned with these great truths, but they don't even know the basic rules of kosher. So part of what Ibn Kaspi might be doing here is to say, at times, you know, even philosophers, you should take some Jewish law seriously. He's not saying you have to take all of Jewish law seriously, because, you know, he's very critical of things like the sacrificial order following Maimonides. Ibn Kaspi's commentary, he just basically says, I don't talk about all the sacrifices. We'll skip that part when we get to Vayikra. But certain rituals, he says, are important, and even philosophers should take seriously. And this might be one of them, like prayer.
As a final question, as we bring our dialogue today to a close, can you kindly share with us what you are working on next as your current project?
I'm happy to share a few exciting things that I'm working on. One, and I'm happy to put a plug in because it's coming out hopefully in 2023. I'm co-editing with Jeffrey Clausen and Alan Middleman a book called Jewish Virtue Ethics. It's with SUNY Press. It's going to be a book with 35 chapters, each chapter dealing with a different thinker or approach or movement or work, I should say, dealing with character and virtue in the Jewish tradition. So we're going to have we have chapters on thinkers as wide ranging as Philo, Josephus, Talmud, Maimonides, Nachmanides, the Zohar, Chrysonides, Crescas, Albo, Cordovero, Mendelssohn. I'm just naming some: Rav Salanter, Abraham Isaac Cook, Martin Buber, Mordechai Kaplan, Soloveitchik, Rent, Levinas, and others as well. A chapter on Jewish environmentalism, a chapter on Jewish feminism, and looking at how the idea of virtue and how each one has an idea of virtue and character development. And our intention is to show that character development and virtue is a central part of the Jewish tradition, going all the way back to the Bible until today. And there's a real diversity of different approaches to how one thinks about the nature of virtue in the Jewish tradition, and that there's no one agreed upon model. There's a debate and dialogue between different thinkers going back to antiquity until today. So we're hoping this is going to be a work that's going to create a lot of excitement, read readers, and influence the field of Jewish ethics to take virtue and Judaism more seriously. And I mean, I can say a few other things I'm working on briefly. I'm doing some work on Maimonides, on the environment, on how Maimonides dealt with the natural environment in dialogue with contemporary environmentalism. I'm working a little bit on Maimonides on moral psychology, how he understood the role of the human psyche, the emotions, and the role of the emotions in a flourishing Jewish life. And I'm also going to be presenting a paper at the Association for Jewish Studies coming up in December on a thinker of the 15th century, Yosef Albo, in his polemical work, Sefer HaIkarim. And I'm going to, also related to virtue, I'm going to be talking about the virtues of trust and hope, and why he emphasized in his book, Sefer Ikarim, HaIkarim, these theological virtues, why he thought that Jews, especially under persecution at the time and under in Spain, running before, you know, before the Inquisition, have to trust, believe, have trust, and they also have to believe in hope, and why these are important Jewish virtues, different than the ones I emphasized in Gersonides, such as endeavor and diligence. Less on the individual, but more on why the collective, and where these virtues come from, and why he's emphasizing them in his work.
Thank you. I wish you only the best of luck. These sound like outstanding initiatives and tremendous projects that will make significant contributions to Jewish readers and to anyone who's interested in ethics and morality from both an academic perspective and an everyday perspective.
Ari, it's been wonderful to speak. I appreciate your very generous questions. And you really got the heart. You asked me great questions. I really got to the heart of what I was working on. So I hope all my readers are as read the book as seriously as you and ask such great questions.
So thank you.
Thank you for the interview.
Thank you. I could not have been more appreciative to read this amazing book and to be in dialogue with you. So thank you for all the erudition and eloquence you invested in this book, as well as all the sacrifice that goes into bringing such a masterpiece into fruition.
It's been a fun conversation. I hope we'll have many more in the future.
My pleasure. I look forward to it. To our listeners, I'm your host, Ari Barbalat, on the New Books Network. I've been in dialogue today with Professor Alexander Green. Dr. Green is a visiting associate professor and Buffalo Community Jewish educator at SUNY University at Buffalo in the Department of Jewish Thought. He is the author of Power and Progress, Joseph Ibn Caspi and the Meaning of History, published in Albany by State University of New York Press, 2019. Thank you, and thank you, Alex.